This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform for creating a blog, a website, a portfolio, or an online store. Create your own space today by visiting squarespace.com and use offer code TREK10 to save 10%. Plus, if you'd like to support our programming personally, visit trek.fm/donate to get our alien badges and art prints featuring original illustration by Tobu Ushi.
I'm Jeff Combs. I'm everywhere on Star Trek, and you keep tuning in to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 115, The Cage 2, Electric Boogaloo. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Mike Schindler. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the next stop for Destination Star Trek, how you can build your own NX-class refit, the 2014 Trek calendar lineup, and Brian Fuller's desire to bring Star Trek back to television, and what form that might take. Then in the feature, we're joined by Drew Stewart to discuss the very first episode of Star Trek to ever hit the airwaves, The Man Trap. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Mike. It's great to have you with me on the Ready Room for the first time ever. Co-hosting, of course, you've been on the show in the feature a number of times. How are things going there? You're in Chicagoland, is that right?
Yes, I am. Things are going pretty well. It's October, so that means the Major League Baseball playoffs are in full swing, so can't really get much better than that. There's a quadruple header today. I mean, come on, right?
It's funny because, you know, college football season's going, so baseball's about the farthest thing from my mind these days.
Yeah, I know that what that's like in reverse.
But of course, if you live in Chicago, I mean, Major League Baseball is the thing.
Not this year, but yes, it is a thing. It is a thing for sure.
Of course, you've also got the Bears.
We do. They're doing pretty well, all things considered. They lost this week, but you know, what can you do?
What can you do? You know, I have to ask you, living in Chicago there, how do you feel about, you know, in network here, how do you feel about living in such close proximity to the ISS, the International Sex Symbol, Tristan Riddell?
You know, it's kind of weird because I've met a lot of people on Trek FM, but so far, Tristan and I have never run into each other. One of these days, I will meet him in the flesh. But until then, he's been able to avoid me. So good.
I think
for
he's
him.
Got the cloaking device turned on. I think the ISS has a cloaking device.
Does it? Okay. All right. Well, that makes
Seems
sense.
That way.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's jump into our news here. And we have a few stories today. And the first one was, I was interested to see this. Of course, Star Trek fans over in the UK finally got to have that huge convention that they had been wanting for so long with Destination Star Trek London. And there's been some debate over whether there's going to be a second one or whether Destination Star Trek is going to go elsewhere. And the news came out that Frankfurt is going to host the next Destination Star Trek Con. It's Destination Star Trek Germany, which is slated for February of next year. And we were talking in the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
About this. And Mike, you said you thought that Germany was kind of an odd choice for this.
Well, yeah. I mean, the big European, I guess now it's more than just Star Trek, but Star Trek convention, sci-fi convention is FedCon, which of course is always held in Germany. And the idea of, you know, there being another Star Trek convention now, again, also in Germany, when they basically had all of Europe to choose from, seems a bit strange. You'd think that they'd want to exploit another market like they did last time around.
Yeah, that makes some sense when you put it that way, because Germany being, I mean, relatively small as country, as all European countries are because of the geography, having two events there. But at the same time, for me, when I saw this, I thought that it made a lot of sense. If they weren't going to do it in the UK, Germany is the next country that I would have chosen, just because if you think about the markets that have the most Star Trek fans, I feel Germany is probably third after the US and the UK. And I may be wrong about that if we actually break down the exact numbers. I know that on Trek FM, we have quite a lot of listeners in Germany. I know that when you see DVD releases, when you see television releases for Star Trek, Germany is one of the places they get all the special steelbooks for Blu-ray releases. And in terms of Star Trek novels, Germany is a huge market. And in fact, the German versions of Star Trek novels have some of the most beautiful cover art. They usually have different covers than the US releases. So it made a lot of sense to me that they would do this there.
Yeah, I see your point. But at the same time, I think the UK seems to be like really hungering for a Star Trek convention, even still, even after the last one. And
yeah, I think so.
You know, to me, it seems like a no-brainer to spread it out, you know, or maybe, you know, do what FedCon has done and find a location which is stable, you know, so that every year people can plan on going to one place. I know that, you know, yeah. A lot of conventions don't do that, but I don't know. That's what I would have done. But what do I know about running conventions?
Oh, I thought you and Max had your own convention.
Well, we do in my apartment. But usually the only three attendees are me, Max, and my cat. So, but we have a fun time. Cat signs autographs. It's pretty awesome. And he doesn't charge either, you know.
So, oh, really? Little paw print on the ink pad?
Right. For free.
Get him to do it with red ink, and it'll be just like in Japan, you know. We don't sign our names on documents here. We put stamps on things with red ink. So your cat would fit right in here.
That's pretty cool. And, you know, he probably could sign, because if you look at my cat, he looks just like Spot. He is a Spot impersonator. And, you know, he got all these people, like I saw at FedCon, for example, Aaron Eisenberg and Max Grodenchik. That's how you pronounce it, right? They're going to be appearing in costume as Rom and Nog. You can get your picture with them. My cat could do that. He could charge like $85 a shot, you know?
To be Spot?
Yeah. Yeah. He looks just like Spot. He really does.
Might even win the costume contest.
He might. He might.
Well, I think a question here with Destination Star Trek is, and maybe they don't know yet, you know, Media 10 and Showmasters Limited put on Destination Star Trek London. And you can think of the event as Destination Star Trek London. Like, that's the name of the event. Or you can think of it as Destination Star Trek London. And London happened to be the first city. And so now they're going to do Germany. So the question is this going to be something that moves around place to place once a year? Could they do it once every 6 months? Could it be like the smaller creation cons where you have the big Las Vegas one, but you have these smaller ones? Or is it going to be set in one place? And, you know, maybe they don't know yet even what they're going to do with it. So it could be that there's still going to be a Destination Star Trek London sometime in 2014 as well as this one here in Frankfurt. Although it feels like Europe is small enough that you would want to have one big one every year and let people travel over to it.
Not to mention the fact that, unlike, you know, here in the States, I imagine it's a lot harder to get all of those, you know, celebrities to fly out to Europe on, you know, more than once a year.
Yeah, you'd have to have different sets of actors at different events. Mm-hmm. So, you know, part of me wishes that they're doing that, the moving around idea, because I would love to have a Destination Star Trek Tokyo at some point, because, you know, Star Trek is not really a big thing here, but there are Star Trek fans here. There actually is a Star Trek fan club in Japan. And CBS is making some new efforts to push Star Trek here again. And it would be great to have it, you know, over at Big Sight, you know, a venue like they have the Tokyo Game Show, to have a big Star Trek convention there and see how it goes. But I don't know. I'm kind of skeptical that that's ever going to happen for me.
Yeah, I wouldn't hold your breath. But it would be nice to see.
It would be nice to see, yeah. So tickets are available now. The guests will be announced soon. And you can go to destinationstartrek.com and get details as they're available. You can get your tickets there as well. So if you are in Germany, again, February 21st through 23rd of 2014, this is going to take place at the Messe Frankfurt. And again, Media 10, I'm sure they'll have a lot of information coming out. Maybe we'll even be able to get them on for an interview as we did last year for the London show. You know, Colin had them on Trek News and Views, so maybe we'll be able to find out more for you there as well. So stay tuned on that.
Yeah, and I'm hoping that some people like Colin or whoever can get over there to cover it. I don't know how easy that is, but you know, the Trek FM coverage of Destination Star Trek London was quite good, and I hope that can be repeated next year.
Yeah, I hope so. I'm sure we'll work that out somehow. So one thing you might need to get over there, you might need your own ship, Mike, to fly over if you want to go. And one way you could do that would be in the NX-01, but not just the NX-01, but the refit, the very cool refit that Doug Drexler did of that ship. And we never got to see that on screen, but we've seen it on calendars, Ships of the Line calendar, for example. And it's a really cool design, and it's now going to be available for toy collectors in a model. And this was spotted at the iHobby Expo by a man named Joseph F. Kaminsky, who shared some photos with TrekWeb. And this looks pretty cool. I'm almost tempted to get this model when it comes out myself.
Yeah, I didn't even know that there was such thing as a refit NX-01. So to see an actual physical representation of it is pretty cool.
Well, you need to go over on the network, go over to Warp 5. I believe it's episode 6, where we had Doug Drexler on the show. And there's a segment in the show where we actually talk extensively about the process of creating the refit, what some of the goals were in it. So you should go check it out, and you can really learn about what Doug was trying to do with the ship. But one of the basic things is that it was a transition point between the NX-01, which was based on the Akira class, bridging the gap over to the Constitution class that we get later on. So you get to see the nacelle struts change a bit. You get to see the secondary hull added. So you've got the saucer section coming up. It's not as flat as Archer's ship is on the series. But the saucer section itself still looks very much like the NX-01.
Yeah, it looks really cool, and I can definitely see the progression. I would totally get this model if I had the patience to build models.
Did you build models when you were younger?
No, I bought a lot of them and was like, I'm totally going to build this model, and then I never did.
I used to build a lot when I was a kid. My father and I would build some airplanes and ships primarily, but it was always fun to put them together and especially fun to paint them. So that would be cool to get this and actually try to paint the hull to really look like the television series. This apparently, and it's not clear from the story, but looking in the photos that were snapped, it looks like these toys are coming from AMT, because there's a little thing off to the side, not of the ship, but of another toy called the USS Enterprise Exploration Set, which has like a tricorder and a phaser with it. There's a little AMT placard next to that. And knowing that AMT has done models in the past, I assume that this NXR is coming from them. And they've done models of the 1701 B, C, D, and E in the past, the Reliant, DS9, the whole station, Bird of Prey, the K7 station from The Trouble with Tribbles. And they even have the Romulan Bird of Prey from Balance of Terror that has the cool bird painting on the bottom. Would you like to take on painting that, Mike?
No.
All right, Mike, so you're not going to paint the big bird on the Romulan ship. Okay, I get it. Why don't you tell us what the other toys are that are available, though, for those who aren't into the ship?
Well, for one thing, they have the bridge of the original series Enterprise, which looks pretty cool, all things considered.
I can't tell if those are action figures that you can move around, like move their arms, or if they're molded into those positions, sitting in the chairs, standing by the turbo lift.
My guess would be that they're molded. Just looking at the different poses and stuff like that, it really does look like it is kind of a stationary setup.
Yeah.
But they are pretty cool, you know?
The detail of the bridge is pretty amazing, actually. All the images they have on the screens, as well as the diagram of the Enterprise there by the turbo lift.
It is nice. Like when I was a kid, I had the playset that they did for the action figures for the Enterprise D, and it was just kind of wonderful being able to kind of look at a three-dimensional model of that place, which we're so familiar with from watching on a weekly basis or daily basis, depending on the situation. So seeing that here
four times daily basis.
Yeah. So seeing that here for the original series is pretty cool as well.
Yeah, it looks quite nice. So there's that, and then there's the item I mentioned earlier, which is this exploration set. I think you need this. I can just picture you guys, again, maybe you and Max and your cat. So the cat can be Isis, and one of you can be Gary Seven, one of you can be Roberta Lincoln. I think since Max isn't here, we'll make him Roberta Lincoln.
Fair enough.
Plus, I mean, think all the cool clothing he could put on.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. So then we would need this exploration set.
Yeah, to go around town. Yeah.
Okay, it comes with a phaser, a tricorder, and a communicator.
Right.
Which looks pretty cool.
No M5 computer.
No M5 computer. Well, that'll be in the second round coming out next Christmas.
Or maybe if you buy the bridge set, the exploration set, and the NX refit model, and you trim off the proofs of purchase and you mail them in, maybe they'll mail you the M5 computer set.
That'd be pretty cool. I would actually buy all of those things, even if I didn't want them, just to get that computer set.
When I was a kid, I had the Yoda action figure from Empire Strikes Back. They had the little cloth suit and the little snake around its neck. And the only way to get that Yoda figure was to collect the proofs of purchase from other Star Wars action figures and then mail them in. And then, you know, like 6 to 8 weeks later, they mailed you in this little box, little tiny box, had the Yoda figure inside.
For those people who don't know, can you explain what The Empire Strikes Back is? Because this is a Star Trek show, right?
Hey, this may be a Star Trek show, but we have a whole collection of sound effects, as all listeners know, for Star Wars, because it's mentioned so often on this show.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough.
The Empire Strikes Back is the search for Spock of the George Lucas franchise. How's that? Does that work?
If Max were here and he heard you say that, oh my God. You better hope he doesn't listen to this or else you will get some mail about that.
I'm looking forward to it. Okay, so again, these toys are coming soon. We'll put a link to some photos in the show notes, and then we'll keep you posted as we find out more information about them. Anyway, if you want to check out these and pick up the ship and the toys. And speaking of ships, Mike, one more story here. Calendars. It's hard to believe that it's October as we're recording this, October 8th, in fact. And 2013 is almost over. So it's time to start thinking about calendars. Now, do you typically have a Star Trek calendar anywhere in your home, in your workplace?
I used to get them for my workplace, but don't really have them anymore. I was always torn when I'd buy them because you can go with the ones which have sort of the publicity stills and the calendar, which you can actually use as a calendar, or you could go with the more artistic ones, which are really kind of, you know, works of art, but are completely impractical as calendars.
Like the Ships of the Line calendar with the tiny, tiny
right
dates at the bottom, mm-hmm. the bottom corner. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely beautiful, but you can't use those things.
Right.
They do you no good.
Exactly.
So I was always torn.
Yeah. What I typically do is I buy two. I buy, like you said, the one with the publicity stills. That's what I use as my actual calendar. Have it right over there at the end of my desk here in the studio. And then I buy the Ships of the Line calendar, which I put back on the wall just for the images of the ships themselves. And I don't even try to use it as a calendar.
See, they get you twice. That's their goal. It works.
I guess, yeah, maybe so. Now, a long time ago, I used to also buy the desk calendar, which, you know, has the single sheet for every single day that you tear off.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't bought that in many years, but what I used to do when I worked in pre-press at a magazine, I had one colleague, and we worked in this small room with a drum scanner. This was long before the days of digital cameras. This was back in the mid-90s. And we sat in this room all day long. We were both big Star Trek fans. So one of the highlights of the day was to take the page from the Star Trek desk calendar each day and write our own captions for what was going on in the scene, because it would have a scene from an episode. And the captions usually had to do with the characters talking about another one of our colleagues.
Yeah, that makes sense. We Max and I, when we worked together, we had a daily calendar from Star Trek. And all I remember about it is there was one day where, for whatever reason at work, things were just going absolutely crazy, upside down, you know, insane. And as if it were intended, as if the makers of the calendar knew, for that day they had a picture of the original series Enterprise, but for some reason they messed it up and it was upside down. So we took that day and we taped it to the wall, and it stayed there for the next few years. Just to remind us.
That reminds me, there's one DVD. Is it Generations, where one of the DVDs, the Enterprise, is printed upside down on the DVD itself?
Just, it could be. I don't even remember.
There's one that's misprinted like that. Just you reminded me of it mentioning that. So, well, you know what I miss is that back in the day when Star Trek was the 90s, the golden era of Star Trek, and even bleeding over into the 2000s, you could really choose which calendar you wanted. You know, they had a calendar for every series, and then they had a movie calendar, and they had the Ships of the Line calendar. And in recent years, it's just TOS and Ships of the Line. It's just, that's all you've been able to choose from. And I really miss that, because I used to get the DS9 calendars quite often, and I would change it up, you know, year to year, but I would always have a Star Trek calendar on my wall. I've had a Star Trek calendar on the wall in my workspace every year since probably 1994, I think. So that's about 20, almost 20 years now.
Yeah.
And I still do it, but I miss the variety.
Yeah, no, I can definitely understand that. I haven't been quite as loyal. There have been years where I've gotten Battlestar Galactica calendars or Chicago White Sox calendars, but sorry, Star Trek.
You know, that's one thing that we don't have a sound effect for here on the Ready Room: Chicago White Sox baseball.
Oh, I can provide you with many if you want.
I need to see what you come up with for that. So
for this year, it's just a constant, like, 5-minute, like, crying session, you know. It's been a bad season.
So, but despite the fact we don't have the variety in series anymore, we do have a variety of calendars to choose from. There are at least 7 calendars available around the world for Star Trek for 2014. There's the Ships of the Line calendar from CBS, the original series calendar from CBS, the Into Darkness calendar, again from CBS, and the 16-month engagement calendar, which I believe is the proper name for the desk calendar that we've been talking about, from CBS. So those are the ones you'll get in the US. Now, over in the UK, there's Danilo, who does calendars as well, and they have their own Ships calendar and their own Into Darkness movie calendar. And some of their calendars, actually, I kind of like the artwork on them a little bit better than the CBS ones.
Yeah, the Ships of the Line, or the, I guess not Ships of the Line, but the Ships calendar that they're doing is really cool looking, and it has a variety of ships from across the franchise, and I'm really digging it. I would totally get it if it wasn't for the PAL conversion issue. They only have like 25 days a month over there, right?
Something like that. I think there's a converter there. You can slide the calendar in. It'll convert it to NTSC calendar for you.
Oh, well, in that case,
yeah,
I'll totally buy that calendar.
But they have some cool ships on there that we don't see so often. They have a Vulcan ship like we saw in Enterprise, you know, with the big ring on it. It's a very weird design for a ship, but I don't know. It kind of reminds me of 2001 A Space Odyssey a little bit, except in rust.
Yeah, yeah, it is cool. And then they have like the underbelly of the E from First Contact, it looks like.
Right.
And a rather classic photo of the A from when we first see that in Star Trek 4, and then when we see it again in Star Trek 5, and then again in Star Trek 6. Yeah, it's a really nice calendar, and even Nero's ship from Star Trek 09.
Exactly. Now, have you been reading the comics by any chance? The After Darkness comics and the ongoing 25?
No, I read everything up to the movie, and then I was like, I need to finish the video game before I read the Gorn comic.
Okay, well,
I'm really slowly starting to realize that that's not going to happen anytime soon, no. So I need to pick up the comics and just start again.
I started the video game, and I didn't finish it, and I went ahead and read the comic, and I was just fine. The reason I ask is that you talk about Nero's ship here, and what they've done in the comics is that the Klingons have these birds of prey that are a hybrid between the bird of prey and Nero's ship here, with the back of it has the same sort of kind of needles coming out towards the back. It's kind of a really interesting looking design. And on the calendar here, they have a bird of prey and this ship right next to each other. So you should check that out. It's quite interesting. So this is a nice calendar. And then also there is the Into Darkness calendar, which you can pick up there as well. And let me ask you this, because you're the film guy, Mike. In all the artwork that they show of the Enterprise and the Vengeance together, the Vengeance looks like it's 100 times bigger than the Enterprise. But in the movie, it doesn't actually seem to be as big compared to the Enterprise as it does in a lot of the artwork. I know it's creative license, but does that ever kind of throw you off a little bit?
You know, I never really thought of it. But now that you mention it, I probably won't be able to not think about it anytime I see a picture of the two of them together. So thanks, Chris. for ruining that for me.
Just look at the cover of this calendar here.
I'm looking at it right now. I guess you're right. But that is an awesome cover. I think that was... if it's not the same image, it's a very similar image to the one that was used for the IMAX poster, correct?
Right, yeah. Very similar.
Yeah, that's pretty sweet.
So that's nice. Yeah. So anyway, we'll put a link in the show notes. We wanted to let everyone know that there are a lot of different calendars to choose from for 2014, and they are available now. So if you want to check them out. And of course, I don't know about you, Mike. My tactic for buying calendars is that I always buy them in January because I can get them for half price.
Yeah, half price. Yeah, you don't even have to wait till January. Just wait till December 26th, half price.
Oh, like in the U.S. in shopping malls, they have the little kiosks in the middle. Yeah, everyone's got to pack up. Their rent space for the kiosk runs out in December, right? So they've got to unload their inventory.
Exactly.
Okay, well, we have one more story, and this one I'm especially interested in getting your thoughts on, Mike. Which is the story about Brian Fuller. Well, the headline said Brian Fuller wants to explore rebooting The Next Generation. And now the article I read itself was more like Brian Fuller wants to explore the possibility of future Star Trek on television. It was a little bit less about let's recast Picard than the headline suggested. But what do you think about this?
I think it's really interesting, especially since it's not the first time that Brian Fuller brought this up. It's not even the second time. It's the third time, as far as I can tell. It goes all the way back to 2008, before the first JJ movie, where he said that he would be interested in doing a Star Trek series. At the time, he was talking about it being related to the JJ verse, but following like a different ship, but being very much in the spirit of the original series. Then in 2012, he was talking about doing it when he was going around promoting his Munsters remake show that he did with Bryan Singer.
What was that?
Because
Mockingbird Lane, is that what that was called?
Yes, Mockingbird Lane. Yeah. That's correct, yeah. Because Singer had, of course, been working on a Star Trek show with Robert Meyer Burnett, right before the new movie was announced. And when the new movie was announced, they basically gave up. But now that Brian Fuller and Brian Singer are friends and both Star Trek fans, you know, they were talking about it again. And now here's the third time. So this to me tells me that this isn't just a guy who's, you know, saying, oh yeah, that would be cool to do someday. Yeah, even right here in the current article, he says, Star Trek is such a big universe and there's so many places to go with it. I have a very specific idea that I would love to do. We'll see if I ever get the opportunity. So, I mean, hey, I personally am not very familiar with Brian Fuller's work. I've obviously seen his Star Trek stuff and I saw Heroes and that was a mess. But I haven't seen the other stuff. I'm dying to see Hannibal and everyone's saying that it's really, really good. So the idea of him coming on and doing a Star Trek show, I think would be great, especially if he had Brian Singer involved.
Well, I'm certainly open to it if he, you know, has an idea and can get CBS on board. I'd love to see Star Trek back on television. He does make one comment in the 2008 article about how he feels that DS9 and Voyager had lost the fun of the 60s series. And it makes me curious about what his idea is, because the thing about DS9, and tell me if you agree with me on this, is that I feel that the way DS9 tells its stories is more in line with what television audiences are expecting out of a television series today, more so than the way that the original series or TNG or Voyager told their stories. And it almost sounds like what he wants to do is to get back away from that and go back to, say, a TOS style of storytelling. And that might work, you know, it could be, but I'm curious what he might come up with.
But I could see both existing. I could see like a continuity driven show in the style of the original series. Mm-hmm. And I think that would be really cool, especially if it was about the USS Excelsior commanded by Captain Sulu.
Now, were you one of the people who wanted to see the Excelsior series after Voyager finished?
I mean, I wanted to see the Excelsior series before Voyager finished, but now, I mean, look at what they did with Into Darkness. They are totally setting that up. I'm saying that was their plan. Now, there was another article or a little video clip that came out this week where J.J. Abrams was asked about the possibility of Star Trek on TV, and he said that he has an idea, or they've talked about it at least, but CBS is not interested.
I saw that.
I thought was really interesting.
Well, I thought it was really interesting because a lot of fans want a new Star Trek series on television. I think there are very few fans, from people I've talked to and the feeling I've gotten and my own feelings, I think there are very few fans who want the next TV series to be set in the Abramsverse timeline. People want a Prime Universe Star Trek series. And what's interesting to me is that if CBS told JJ we're not interested, it makes me think that CBS is working on something else. Because I really believe Star Trek is coming back to television in the near future. And with all the money that these movies have made, with the huge crowds that are coming out to Star Trek Las Vegas and Destination Star Trek London, with the resurgence of the literary universe as well, studio executives have to be looking at Star Trek and seeing, like, people are ready for more content. And with the 50th anniversary coming up, I feel like they may be working on something and they don't need JJ and the Abramsverse to take the next step in the franchise.
I agree that I think they're working on something, and I agree that 2016 seems to be the logical time for that something to appear. Whether or not JJ is involved, I don't know, but to me, I just cannot see them going back to the Prime Universe. As much as the fans want it, you know, this is the same thing that, Roddenberry was struggling with in the 60s. You know, he would come back from conventions and say, I showed them Where No Man Has Gone Before. They all loved it. And apparently there were executives who said, you know, well, who cares about what a few thousand people at a convention think. We need something which will go across the board, you know, all of America. And as much as fans seem to not like the JJ movies, America and the world does seem to like the JJ movies. They're extremely popular. And I can't see them going back. And honestly, as a Star Trek fan, and as someone who, you know, hypothetically doesn't like the JJ verse and is a you know, wants to see something in the Prime universe, I don't think that the problems that people have with the JJ verse would translate to a TV show, depending on who's making it. There's no reason why you can't tell any story that you're telling in the Prime universe in the JJ verse. And I also wonder, if you do something in the Prime universe, where do you go? What do you do? The only idea I've ever heard about that, I mean, if you go 100 years in the future, then what is that? You know, everyone said that back then, you know, when Enterprise came out. You know, what do you, you said another show in that time period. How many more advancements can you, you know, make or whatever? I did like the idea that Singer and Burnett had about setting it way, way, way in the future and having the Federation essentially collapse under its own weight. Yeah. But I can't see that as being the next Star Trek show either.
Yeah, I think that would be interesting, but I don't know if the public would take to it. So let's say one more question here, because you said you wanted to see the Excelsior series for a long time, and I was someone who did not want to see the Excelsior series, largely because, and I love George Takei, and he's funny, and he's a great guy, but I could not imagine watching a TV series every single week where George Takei was the lead. I don't think I could do it.
Send your mail to Chris at trek.fm.
I don't know. I mean,
I would totally watch that.
I don't know. I just, based on the Undiscovered Country, I don't feel like, based on the Undiscovered Country and Flashback from Voyager, I don't feel like I could feel that as the lead captain every single week. You know, I just, I don't know. But anyway, my question to you is, if they stay in the Abrams verse, how would you feel about an Excelsior series with John Cho as the lead every week?
If they stay in the Abrams verse and it's not the Excelsior series with John Cho as the lead every week, I'm going to be very, very disappointed. Let's put it that way. If they go back to the Prime universe, I don't know what they're going to do, but they need to get someone with a very strong vision. If they bring in people like Singer and Burnett to do something crazy, I'm all for it. You know, if they bring in Ira Stephen Bear or Ronald D. Moore,
well, that'd be great.
They can do whatever they want, yeah, and I will watch it. I don't care, because I totally trust those guys.
Yeah.
But if it's just, you know, random TV producer, you know, no, that's not going to work.
Well,
you know,
and the thing, the problem with the Abrams verse 2 is, for me, if it were a television series, if it were the Bad Robot team doing it, I would have some concerns, because I just feel like, I feel like Orci and Kurtzman, they're good at coming up with basic stories that are kind of interesting. They're not good at figuring out where to take those stories or resolving those stories. And I would be concerned about them as being the writing team. And so maybe CBS telling JJ that we're not interested, maybe that's a good sign that maybe they'll stay in this timeline, but maybe they're not going to bring that whole team in.
I don't know. I mean, for one thing, I don't think that Kurtzman and Orci, even if they were the producers, I don't think that they would take an active role in the series, because they've got like 17 movies which they're writing right now. And I don't see them going back to TV to do this. I think their role would be similar to the role on all the other TV shows that they're executive producers on, where they, you know, write the pilot and whatever and then hand it off to someone else. And if you look at those shows and the teams that they're handing them off to, they're all really talented people, and those shows are all really successful. So, I mean, I see that as sort of being realistically the way that the Star Trek series would go if Kurtzman and Orci were involved. And as long as they get the right people in there, and I mean, there's no reason to think that they wouldn't, based on their track record at least, then I'm all for it. And you know what? not even that. I'm not even going to qualify it like that. If Kurtzman and Orci were to do a TV show, I'd be all for it because I think that they're both really, really good writers. And I think that both Star Trek 09 and Into Darkness are really, really good movies. There, I said it. You can send your hate mail on that one to me at trek.fm.
We need a bin for the show for hate mail. Some to you, some
just
to me, based on the things
trek.
We said.
FM.
We said. We'll set up a special form for that.
Can I just make two more points about this? If J.J. Abrams is not involved in this new series, I don't think it's going to be because of creative differences so much as it is CBS being mad at him for basically telling them that he doesn't want them to make a TV show for all of this time so that he can make his movies. That's one point. Another point is, I think if you have someone like Brian Fuller, who right now is at the top of the TV world, wanting to make a Star Trek show, and you don't go with someone or someone of equal caliber, then you're making a really big mistake. Because the fans, when your new show doesn't do well and turns out terrible with, you know, whoever they do get, they're going to think, well, why didn't you get Brian Fuller? He said he had an idea, you know?
Yeah.
So I think, I don't know. I think that this new show will be okay, whatever it ends up being.
Well, we'll see what happens. I'm just really excited at the prospect of Star Trek coming back to television. And of course, the story doesn't mean that it's going to happen or that Brian Fuller will be involved. Who knows? But I do feel like the studio, they're all about making money. They have to recognize that there's money to be made in bringing Star Trek back to television. And as we said, the 50th anniversary is coming up in a couple of years, and I think that we're going to see something. So we'll put some links in the show notes to these stories. There's the newest story over on 1701 News, and then we have the two older stories from Trek Movie, and you can go and, you know, see what was said about that. Okay, Mike, well, that's all we have in news today. But before we jump into our feature, where we're going to be joined by Drew to talk about the Man Trap, let's tell everyone about our sponsor for this week's show, Squarespace. Now, your support of our sponsor is very important for making it possible for us to bring the Ready Room to you every week. And, you know, the great thing about supporting our sponsor is you're going to get the web's best hosting and content management at the same time. And Squarespace makes it simple for you to create your own space online. And that could be a blog, it could be a website, it could be a portfolio, an online store. Or Mike, you can set up your own blog about how wonderful the Abramsverse is and why the Excelsior show should be the next Star Trek series on television.
Yeah, and it sounds like for someone like me who knows absolutely nothing about computers, Squarespace would be an ideal tool to use.
It would. It would make it very easy for you to espouse your love for Hikaru Sulu to the world. And also a great place, they have great image galleries on there as well. So when you and Max and your cat take that exploration kit outside, you know, and roam around town, you can share all the photos with everyone there as well. Now, Squarespace has beautiful designs for you to start with and all the style options that you need to create a unique website for you or your business are there, and it's incredibly easy to use, and it starts at just $8 a month, and that also includes a free custom domain name if you choose the annual plan. So, ilovesulu.com, right there for you, Mike. You can grab that.
Awesome.
But, you know, there are three key things about Squarespace that make me love it, especially over other platforms, and the first one is design focus, because I am a professional designer. I really, really care about design, and Squarespace starts with professionally designed templates that are extremely clean, and they allow your content to be the focus of the website. And the tools make it very easy for you to customize that look by dragging blocks on the page or adjusting variables using sliders. Choose custom fonts. You can connect it to Typekit. Of course, they have all the Google Web fonts in there as well, so you can really make the site your own. And once you get your site ready to go and you get that content up there, connected accounts makes it very easy for you to share your content with the world. You can connect your site to Twitter, to Facebook, LinkedIn, Pinterest, Instagram, Google+. There are so many other services available. And that's not the little share thing that you're thinking about that you see on a lot of sites, although that's there as well. This is actually a way for you to choose when you post something to push that out to social media automatically. So the site will do that for you and let everyone know that that content is there so they can come and read it. And they're going to read it on a desktop or a mobile device these days. People use their phones, their tablets, as well as their desktop. And the responsive design of Squarespace makes sure that your site looks beautiful on any screen, regardless of the size or the orientation. You just design the site one time, and then it reflows for the device that's being used. So, for example, on the desktop, if you have sidebars, those flow up underneath instead of being crammed into that small screen space. So it makes it very easy to read. Great menu options to navigate your site as well on mobile devices. So responsive design is really fantastic. Then there's also the commerce feature, which was added not too long ago. It's available in the US, Canada, and the UK now. And that allows you to sell goods online. It could be physical goods or digital goods. Squarespace has teamed up with Stripe to make it easy for you to process credit cards, to manage shipping, calculate taxes, do all the things that you need to do to run your business online easily without having to get a third-party service and integrate it into your site. It only takes a few minutes to set up, and you can be processing orders, taking credit cards, and you only pay a small fee to Stripe for credit cards that you process just like you would any service. You don't pay anything to Squarespace, and the commerce feature runs just $24 per month. So it's the most economical way that I've ever found online, and I've had to set up shops for clients in the past. Really the best way that you can find to run an online store. But you know, the best way to find out how good Squarespace is and how easy it makes it for you to create your online presence is just to try it for yourself. And you can do that free for 14 days. There's no credit card required. You just enter your name and your email address, and in a matter of minutes, you'll be building your own website. And if you already use a platform like WordPress, you can import your current site and see how it's going to look on Squarespace and how the tools give you everything you need to create an exceptional website. And best of all, as a Trek FM listener, you can save 10% off your lifetime purchase on new accounts by using offer code TREK10. And as I mentioned earlier, if you choose the annual plan, you can get that free custom domain registration as well. So support our sponsor and support the Ready Room. Visit Squarespace and use offer code TREK10. And we really thank Squarespace for their support of the network. And we thank you for supporting Squarespace. And that really helps us bring this programming to you every week.
You're exactly as I remember you.
After The Cage was rejected by NBC, Gene Roddenberry was given an unprecedented second chance to bring Star Trek to the screen. Three new pilot outlines were written, and finally one was chosen. And that script is not the one we will discuss today. However, we will be discussing the very first episode of Star Trek that the public ever saw, The Man Trap. And to help us do that, we have, of course, with us our TOS editor, Drew Stewart, also known as Landrew. Hello, Landrew.
Joy to you, friends. It's good to be here.
It's good to have you back. How's everything going there today?
It's all right. It's getting much better now that I'm rolling into recording. This is great.
Okay. Very good. All right, guys. So as I said just a moment ago, we're going to talk about Star Trek's non-pilot first episode, The Man Trap. And
not the Corbomite maneuver?
Not the Corbomite maneuver, no.
So the first episode shown, not the first episode filmed, or the first episode shot, or the first episode.
Right. Exactly. That's what we're going to talk about. It's very confusing at the beginning of TOS.
Turnabout Intruder? I mean, that's all that's left at this point, right? No?
Right.
Okay. So, The Man Trap was actually, including The Cage, was the sixth episode filmed. but it was chosen as the first to air because the studio found various reasons to eliminate the other contenders. And also, apparently, The Mantrap felt to them like a safer first impression for Star Trek because it had a straightforward plot and it had monster action to thrill the audience. And it was not considered to be too exotic. Although I think that in the 1960s, the idea of some kind of monster living on a red planet that has a salt fetish is kind of exotic. But what do you guys think about just the mere fact that The Mantrap was the first episode that was aired, even though it was nowhere near the first episode written or shot?
Well, I guess I can see why they would have chosen this episode, or at least why it was a contender, you know, because it basically didn't need any special effects, comparatively speaking. So it was one that they could get out, you know, fairly quickly. But since Where No Man Has Gone Before was already in the can, I really don't understand why that wasn't the obvious choice. For one reason, I mean, it's a really, really good episode, but also it's obviously setting up what would come next. You know, I mean, you have Gary Mitchell as the first officer, and spoilers, he dies, and then Spock takes his place and everything. I don't understand why you wouldn't make that episode one.
Thanks for that spoiler alert there, Mike. I appreciate that. You know, it's interesting. They say that Where No Man Has Gone Before was considered too expository to be the very first thing that the audience saw.
Which is very strange, because you look at pilots nowadays and they're all expository.
Right. I guess it's hard for us to understand now with what we're accustomed to. We have to try to think as the audience and as the studio executives in 1966 about that. But even then, I don't really see it myself. I don't see where No Man Has Gone Before would have been a problem as the introductory episode to Star Trek for the audience.
And I don't understand. One of my favorite episodes is the Corbomite Maneuver. And it was the first episode filmed. I'm sure that there were, weren't there like special effects that they weren't done with yet? And so that was one of the reasons.
I think the problem was that they were having, you know how Apple sometimes they have trouble making enough iPhones, you know, to get them out the door. I think that they were having problem with Tranya production. They couldn't get enough Tranya ready for that episode. So they had to delay it a little bit.
Yeah, because Ron Howard's little brother was drinking it all. Is that right, what it was?
Yeah, I know.
Exactly.
I mean, Mantrap and Charlie X were, I think, the two which, realistically speaking, they were debating basically because of they were the ones that were done, you know? And if I'm not mistaken, I think Roddenberry was pushing for Charlie X, but the network went with Mantrap because they wanted to get off the ship, do something on a planet.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And run around the plastic ruins. Mm-hmm.
Right. So here's another interesting thing here while we're talking about the pilot selection process before we get into the actual episode here, is that when NBC said no to The Cage, but they told Roddenberry that we'll let you do another pilot, and that was very unprecedented. I mean, that had never happened before in television at that point. He went and outlined three stories. And tell me what you think about these. Besides Where No Man Has Gone Before, the other two stories that were outlined were Mudd's Women and the Omega Glory.
Wow.
Can you imagine the Omega Glory as
being the first episode?
I'm more than I can imagine Mudd's Women. I don't know. I mean, both of those are crazy choices, but
at least Mudd's Women, I think, is a fine episode. The Omega Glory is just an episode that I think it's pretty weak.
Yeah, that's the one, for those who don't remember, that's the one that ends with Kirk reciting the preamble to the Constitution. What is that?
So with the American flag behind.
With the American flag.
Well, they had,
because they'd lost track of the Constitution or something, and it was some parallel, way too close to a parallel society.
Yeah.
Well, you know, three of those three scripts were being written or whatever, developed, and by three different people. And Omega Glory was the one that Roddenberry was developing. And the studio was not fond of that script at all. But you know, the when they told him, they were like, it's really good. It's really good. But we think Where No Man Has Gone Before is a better representation of what the show could be on the whole. But I guess internally they were like, this is not good at all. So I definitely think they made the right choice.
I have to agree with them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay, well, let's jump into the man trap itself here. And, oh, one more thing before we do that. Well, it is related to the man trap. What I find interesting, too, of course, this was the first episode that aired, but it aired as part of a sneak preview of a new hour-long series called Star Trek. That's how it was billed by NBC. And they aired it on a Thursday night at 8:30 p.m., I guess trying to fill out that time slot. Again, I don't know if... For NBC, I don't know if in 1966, if Thursday night was must-see TV like it was in the 90s, you know, but they're kind of filling out that time slot. And the reaction was very interesting in the magazine Variety. September 14th issue, the reviewer gave Star Trek a really bad review and said that it was dreary and confusing and that it would be better suited to Saturday mornings where it could be viewed by kids.
Oh, that is harsh.
I mean, I could see that happening today, too. You know, some reviewers just don't like certain things, and you read their reviews of movies or whatever that are, you know, excellent and today considered to be classics. And if it just doesn't strike a chord with them, or if they weren't happy that day or whatever, if they were really big fans of Bewitched or whatever happened to be on in that time slot and they were given this assignment, I mean, that could all color their thinking. So
yeah, there were so many fewer reviewers back then that had, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people had a lot of reviews, but in the future everybody's going to be like, well, 500 people said that they liked this movie and 10,000 people said they didn't. And
yeah,
but back then it was just 3 people.
Yeah, so it was just interesting to me that, especially the idea that they should just put it on Saturday mornings. Of course, they tried that later on, right?
Yeah.
With the animated series. Okay, well, let's jump in here. The first thing that I like to talk about is the science fiction setup, because, you know, we had other science fiction shows around the time, but Star Trek, especially with The Cage, which the public never got to see. And it's interesting, actually, too, in the Star Trek Compendium, the old, for those familiar with like the TNG Companion and such, the very old Star Trek Compendium for the original series talks about the cage and talks about it will be interesting to see once the cage is available for home viewing, how people react to it. You know, today we take for granted that we can just watch The Cage anytime we want. But after The Cage, which I think has a very good science fiction set up in the, you know, the traditions of science fiction literature and real sci-fi, real SF. What do we think about the SF setup here in The Man Trap? You know, we have a story about loneliness. We have a story about tragedy. We have a story about compassion towards other life, an area where I think the episode fails. But all of these are good basic components, I think, of science fiction that you might see in a science fiction short story or a novel. What do we think about this setting up Star Trek, though, as a science fiction television show?
I think it showed that they were willing to do something different. It wasn't just a monster who's going to want to eat the crew. Dr. Carter talks about how it also feeds off love and it really strong emotions. And so that's part of its chameleon charm. It's not just to draw you in like a siren, but it also helps it to survive in more ways than one. It's just there's a lot to the salt vampire that we don't, by calling it the salt vampire, kind of minimizes its impact. Even
just calling it the M113 creature help us to find those, though?
Yeah, I guess. I'm sure it wasn't native to M113, though. Can you imagine herds of them, though? What did they look like?
because he compared of them running across the plains.
Yeah.
It probably looked like
Reminds me of, I don't know if you guys have read Douglas Adams's fifth book in the Hitchhiker's trilogy, Mostly Harmless.
Yeah.
But there's the scene where they're on that planet where there's like the little cafe where Elvis plays. But on that planet, there are those herds of beasts that run through. And the leader of the planet called them the perfectly normal beasts so that the people there wouldn't be startled when it happens. They're perfectly normal. Don't worry about them. That's what I'm picturing as you describe herds of these creatures.
Well, they wouldn't startle anybody because they'd look like whatever that person wanted to see.
That's true. Yeah.
Do they actually say that there are herds, or do they just say, remember the buffalo? There were herds. There were a bunch of these things too. But that doesn't mean that they were herding, right? They're probably like hanging out, you know, at like the salt version of
the watering
Starbucks.
Hole.
Well, yeah, the salt watering hole. Yeah, there you go.
It's full of salt water.
Salt lake. Yeah. Just the salt lake.
There you go. Yeah.
There's a giant salt lake and because you notice that apparently the civilization that was on this planet had a stacking fetish as well. Because the first thing you see when you beam down are blocks stacked up. So this was like a stack of salt licks, and all the creatures are hovering around like the water cooler in an office.
You know, what's interesting about the planet is I was just reading that apparently when they were breaking the story or whatever, one of the ideas was that the mind control was going to be much more elaborate. And in fact, the creature was going to have created an entire city on the planet with buildings and everything like that. And when, the producers saw this pitch, they were like, that's a great idea, but we've already had that kind of rejected once. Maybe we should scale it back a bit so that we don't have, don't make this the Cage 2 Electric Boogaloo or anything like that, So that's when they decided to do just the one thing. But originally it was going to have actually like a city, apparently. I don't know. But
like a city that everybody saw differently, that could get expensive.
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I don't think it really got much past the idea stage. Really, I don't think it was in any of the scripts or anything like that. But it was an idea that was tossed around, though, briefly.
It's an interesting idea, but I think they had a good point that this was rejected once. Even though that's probably not the reason the cage was rejected by itself, but still, it would remind the executives of the cage.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they'll say, we told you we didn't want this story.
This whole dream sequence thing. In. Yeah.
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 But I like the monster. I mean, sure, she's goofy looking when she takes off her beautiful mask of whatever you want to see, which I don't know how you can control that. Like the fact that the ensign saw his girlfriend from the Wrigley's Treasure Planet was, and Kirk saw old Nancy and McCoy saw young Nancy. I mean, like that had to have been confusing to be Chameleon and hide like that and just being like,
if I had been guesting in this episode, of course I would have seen Ensign Leffler.
Yeah. That's true.
It's one of those things we could immediately, like, had they mentioned the hair color in the first 5 seconds, the episode would have been over. Like, she's got gray hair. What are you talking about? She's blonde. What are you talking about? She's a brunette. I think she'd probably just attack them all. The series would be over.
Yeah. Instead, we get that really awkward scene where she's like, man, isn't she young? And Kirk's like, No, she's not. She's like, just shut up, Kirk. Come on.
No, Kirk is, she's a handsome woman.
Yeah, she's very handsome.
Sounds very odd to us these days to describe a woman that way. But you talk about the mask, Drew. It's like a reverse Scooby-Doo episode, right? Where here they pull off the human-looking mask to find the creature underneath.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with the way that the creature looks. I think, maybe if you were to just see it standing there, you'd be like, oh, that's kind of goofy. But I think the way that they shot it and everything, and just seeing it for like a very brief period of time and stuff like that, I think it's pretty effective.
I do think the episode might have been, the ending might have been more effective if McCoy shot the creature for the first time with it still in, still disguised as Nancy.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
I mean, as it is, it's just like, ah, look at me. I'm a monster. You should shoot me. And he shoots her. And then she turns into Nancy. And it's still sad. I just feel like it would have been better if.
Well, it's hold your hands near Kirk's face and look and say, you know, if you don't shoot me within the next 10 to 15 seconds, I'm going to put these suction cups on his face. So
I'm going to suck all the
take
salt
a moment, think about
veins.
It, make up your mind. I'll give you a little time to think here before I do it.
Yeah, it instantly kills so many people. But with Kirk, Kirk's got a lot of salt in his veins, apparently. He's a salty, salty pirate captain.
Well, do you like that scene where, disguised as Nancy, the creature is in there with McCoy and wipes McCoy's forehead and then goes to lick its finger? Like, wow, you really are a salt junkie.
I missed that. That's incredible.
Now, that really happens. I'm not making that up. People can't tell when I'm making stuff up on this show or not, but that's actually there in the episode.
Oh, yeah.
But the creature has the same hesitation in the hallway with Uhura as well, where holding the hands up to Uhura for a long time, staring, very creepy, and Uhura is just standing there very calm.
Like, well, they did hypothesize before it was revealed that it was a shape shifter, even if it doesn't shift shapes. They hypothesized that it obviously puts some kind of hypnosis on someone. And I'm wondering if they weren't entirely wrong with that. Like, it's...
That would make
sense.
It
feeds off the love, it feeds off the salt, and it can assume whatever form the person wants it to be, it's multi-talented. It's very science fiction-y, now that I think about
it. That makes sense. All right, well, we'll come back to the creature in a minute. Let's talk about the characters for a moment, because I know it was the fifth episode shot with this cast. It was the fourth episode shot with DeForest Kelly. So it wasn't the very first time they're on the screen together, but still, I mean, think about any TV series and think about 4 or 5 episodes in and how the characters are. I feel like the characters, Kirk and Spock and McCoy, they feel so settled in already in this episode. You know, you feel like you could watch these out of order and you could watch this not knowing where it fell in the 3 series and the 3 seasons and still feel like this is normal Kirk, normal Spock. Spock maybe settles down a little bit more, but normal Bones as well. What do you guys think about that?
Well, yeah, I agree with that for the most part. I think it is kind of crazy how well fleshed out they are, and you know, there were so many different people coming on writing these things for like the very first time, that the idea that it was able to find its voice so quickly is quite impressive. It had to be hard for these guys who had pretty much only seen like what the pilot, you know, to come in and do this. And I know they had a lot of help from, you know, Roddenberry rewriting scripts and stuff like that, but yeah, you're right. It is really, really accurate to how these characters would end up being throughout the series.
Yeah, there are times where I think that it's not the best introduction to said characters. It kind of throws you in the middle of, this is McCoy, he's a doctor, he's been married before, and he's a cranky old man, but he's also got a big heart. And then there's Spock, and he's mean, and he's, you know, logical, and he brushes off Uhura. Uhura is flirty, and then she flirts with Sulu, who's a botanist, and then it's just like bam, 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 bam. But I feel that it does... The characters are dead on. It may not be the best introduction to the characters, but the actors know what they're doing with them by that point.
The actors really feel like the characters, yeah.
Except one thing. Spock and Leonard Nimoy is all about, like, I've been reading Making of Star Trek, you know, from the one that was in 68, and the section on Spock, Leonard Nimoy is like, you know, Spock is nonviolent. You know, I didn't want to play him as violent and stuff. But if you remember at the end of this episode, he beats the crap out of Nancy to try to show McCoy that it's not, obviously not Nancy. Would Nancy be able to take this? And he punches her and he punches her and he punches her and he punches her. And I'm like, that's not very Spocky.
But the one thing that I do think is kind of off, and the one thing which does bother me about it, is it almost seems a little bit too familiar with the characters. And it is so Bones centric that it doesn't, like, it feels like
plum.
There should be, yeah, it's so plum centric that it feels like there should be a the first episode should be like Kirk based, like Kirk and Spock based, but really to me it's almost like it's Bones, then Kirk, and then Spock is over here doing his thing. And I think that's a weird choice for the first episode of the show.
Well, especially within the credits, you have starring William Shatner, Leonard Nimoy. You're only featuring DeForest Kelly, yet the episode centers on someone other than the two stars.
Yeah, he didn't even have a credit during the first season, so it was just Shatner, Nimoy.
On the screen, right, yeah.
Right.
In the actual script, I think he's credited as featuring as, which is the next level down from starring.
Ooh.
So, yeah, but yeah, that's a good point that I've never really thought about that. And I guess the reason that I've never thought about it is that, unlike the other series, with TOS, I rarely ever think about where any of the episodes fall in the series, because mm-hmm. you can watch them all out of order, with the exception of Where No Man Has Gone Before. They all pretty much feel like the same, like they could have all been shot on the same day. You know, Where No Man Has Gone Before still has those, yellowish uniforms Spock's wearing.
The turtlenecks.
Yeah, that. Other than that, you know, I mean, you can mix the series up and you never really feel like anything's out of place. And so I never really thought much about the fact that the very first episode does not center on the leads.
Yeah, we may be more forgiving of it,
yeah,
looking at it as a whole. But for the audience in the 60s, they were looking at it as new science fiction show.
Yeah.
Who's this doctor guy? Thankfully, DeForest Kelly knocks it out of the park like he does in every episode.
Yeah.
So it's not like it's focused on a weak character. Like it's Charlie crazy. X. Like if they brought Charlie, if Charlie X is the first episode, it'd be like it focuses on this kid. No.
But at least there, it's like, you know, that Charlie X isn't, you know, like I don't have any problem with Gary Mitchell being front and center with Where No Man Has Gone Before. And I think like the same thing would be true with Charlie X, where it really is, you know, Kirk dealing with that kid and stuff like that. So that to me would almost seem like it would work better because he is obviously just a guest star. Does that make any sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Before we get too far away from it, something that you just mentioned, Drew, is the scene that I feel like today Star Trek fans forget exists or mm-hmm. don't know exists in the first place, which is that everyone thinks that Orsi and Kurtzman, that they pulled this whole Spock Uhura thing out of their asses somehow, that this scene in here is where Uhura is flirting with Spock. I know it's only a momentary little thing, but...
But this is like the first 10 minutes of the first episode. You know, this is not... It wasn't unbelievable, which is why when I first saw 2009, I was like, really? No, I guess, yeah, that makes sense. They flirted before, because it was that whole moon conversation.
Right, it's just that in 09,
Vulcan has no moon.
They meet earlier, and... It's like during that 7-year cycle, and she like hit him right at the right time in that cycle, and then that's, you know, right?
Nice timing there, Uhura.
Yeah.
Like you said here, it's the moon conversation, and Spock says Vulcan doesn't have a moon. But of course, we learn that actually Vulcan doesn't have a moon. It has a planet called Delta Vega that's extremely close to Vulcan. It's not a moon. It's another planet.
That was Spock's artistic interpretation of events. He's an artist, just like Leonard Nimoy.
He says, Vulcans cannot lie. He's not lying. It's not a moon. Not a moon.
Which Spock's artistic interpretation are you going with? old Spock?
Yeah, old Spock is like, look, I'm going to tell you a story, Kirk, and I'm going to embellish because, you know, that's what storytellers do, you know? I mean, that's like straight up literally what I think is happening there. I've never had a problem with that. I know people are very critical of it. I'm just like, no, Spock is making this interesting, you know? He's a filmmaker.
He's making it visually interesting.
He knows what he's doing, you know? He knows how to tell a story. So, I mean, come on. That's not a problem. Say what you want about Star Trek 09. That's not a problem with that movie. That makes perfect sense. Anyway.
All right, works for me. Okay, well, let's move into the heart of the story here. This is a salty mystery that we have on our hands. And just the idea, okay, so two humans go to live alone on a deserted planet. And then they develop a salt fetish. But two humans, if you were going to do an archaeological expedition, wouldn't you send like a group of scientists or something? Yeah. Just this guy and his wife go there?
That's terrible. I mean, what if one of them died and was killed by some kind of salt vampire?
And a creature fell in love with the other one. What if?
Well, then it would all work out, right?
Obviously.
As long as you've got salt on hand.
Yeah. That's
a weird way to run an archaeological dig, just the two of them. But it does keep the story simple so that there's just a man and his maybe wife, maybe monster, instead of being like, there were 100 people here 3 months ago, and now there's just you and your wife. What happened to all the rest of them? Well, I don't know. They don't have any salt in their veins anymore, I guess.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where, I mean, it works fine for the story. It's just if you stop and think about it, really just these two people went there, and then what, you know, Starfleet drops by like every 5 years or so to check on them, or everything okay? Yeah. What's happening here? It just seemed kind of odd to me, but anyway, they're there. And then we already talked earlier on about the opening and the setup. And how do you feel about it as a story? You know, we talked about it being more of a straightforward plot, which is one of the reasons that the studio gave for why it was chosen as the pilot. I mean, does the story engage you through? Does it make you interested in watching Star Trek as a television series every week?
I'm going to say no. I mean, I honestly think it is a pretty good episode. But if I were to see this episode, I would not have a good idea of what Star Trek actually was. And I don't think that it would intrigue me enough to come back. I mean, that's being said now, although, you know, in the back in 1966, considering the options and what was out there, I probably would come back, you know, because it was something different. But like, it to me does not stand out as you know, must see TV.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the plot, the mystery, the reverse Scooby-Doo mystery is all well and good, and it's got some great dramatic moments where nobody knows that McCoy is the M113 creature, but other than that, it doesn't. You don't get to know the characters very well. Yes, they're well done. They're well rounded, but you know, do Spock and McCoy even share a scene? Like, there's none of the banter. There's not enough of the trifecta, trinity, whatever you want to call it. But the Kirk, Spock, McCoy friendship that I think drives what little continuity there is in the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it would have been better served to have more of that in this episode.
Of course, it would be setting it up because it's early on. But again, this wasn't the first episode filmed, so they did have some time to start bringing that together before they filmed this. You know, I mean, the scripts are being written at different
times. Mm-hmm. I mean, Corbivite Maneuver has it all. I'm going to keep bringing it up, but
yeah,
I love Corbivite Maneuver, and I think I think it would have been interesting. It would have shown strange new worlds and weird aliens, and sure, Clint Howard's creepy and scary, but you know, he's an alien, and you know, they're there to make peace, and they pass a test and stuff. This one, they fail the test. I mean, really.
I don't think that even the creators or the network would necessarily disagree with you about the Corbomite maneuver. I think the big problem is it just wasn't done, you know? It wasn't ready.
Yeah. So. Maybe they should have held off Premiere for a bit to keep it done. But I'm sure that NBC was just like, we need something now. Put it on now.
Oh, sure, yeah. They were running behind schedule as it was, so I'm sure NBC's patience wasn't exactly, you know. But it seemed to work out in the end, right?
Yeah, that's true. People kept watching.
And I think Gene Roddenberry had faith in his vision that the first step was to get it on television. So whatever we have to choose to get it by the studio, to get it on TV so that it can get going, let's just do that. But your comments about the trifecta, Drew, again, is interesting, which I think is the whole issue the problem when we try to talk about the original series is that because it's been around for so long and we know it so well and we've seen these characters for so many years and so many stories, that to us it's a trifecta. It's really hard for us to imagine the start of it all. So we're expecting to see that in the episode, even though it's at the very beginning of the first season. Mm-hmm. And it naturally wouldn't be there. We need to build a time machine. That's what we need. We all need to hop in. You know, Brandon Braga and some guys, they recently restored the DeLorean from Back to the Future. We need to hop in there. You might have to sit in each other's laps there. It's only two seats, but go back in time. Let's record the show in 1966 and feel about, you know, how do we feel about the show right after it came on?
Yeah, it would be interesting to hear. It'd be interesting to hear more than just that variety that didn't like it, but the normal person. I don't think I knew anybody who watched The Man Trap as it aired live.
Yeah.
And it would be interesting to talk to someone like that to find out what they thought. And it would be better if it was 1966 so that they wouldn't be jaded from 45 years of memory or wanting to remember it, that it was better than what it actually was.
Well, the creature itself is the other interesting thing here, and how this episode plays out, again, as an introduction to the public to the concept of Star Trek. And in the Star Trek Compendium, they write about how if Star Trek had followed the format of this episode, the franchise itself would be quite different than what we're accustomed to. Because generally, when we think about Star Trek, you know, it's about seeking out new life. And it's generally about compassion towards life, especially unique life. And here we're dealing with a creature that is the last of its kind. And how do we approach something like that? You know, what kind of compassion do we have towards an animal or an intelligent life form or really any kind of life? How do we decide what should live and what should die? And how do our personal feelings influence our decisions on that? Because that's what we get here with Bones, especially at the end when he's very hesitant to shoot the creature, even after he knows it's a creature. You know, he's colored by his past with Nancy Crater. But Kirk really never makes any attempt to communicate with this creature. It's just, I have to kill it. You know, let's kill this creature. Let's kill this creature. And Mike, you were talking in the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
About this topic and about the original concept of what Roddenberry wanted to do with the creature in the original script, which I thought was really interesting. And I think would have been more Star Trek.
Well, it wasn't what Roddenberry wanted to do with it. It was what the writer George Clayton Johnson wanted to do with it. And it's actually Roddenberry who changed it to what it is. But basically, it doesn't seem like there was a huge change, but it was basically making the character more sympathetic. Like in the original script, the Doctor, Crater, he survives because the creature is in love with him and is not willing to, you know, sacrifice him just to feed or whatever, despite the fact that, you know, it's dying and everything, it still is compassionate. And, you know, they talk about how there was another scene where when the creature is taking the form of McCoy, it goes to see Spock and Kirk and tries to convince them that they shouldn't be killing it. And the two of them are like, oh, no, we totally need to kill this thing. It's going to kill us. And at that point, the creature kind of freaks out and realizes that it doesn't stand a chance. And instead of lashing out at them like a monster would, it runs away. So there was really a sort of an effort early on to portray it not as a monster, but as a scared creature who is afraid of dying, which I think would have been more effective. But you still get that here, you know, with the talk of the buffalo and everything. I mean, the episode even ends with Kirk saying, like, I was just thinking about the buffalo. But then, oh, well, all right, let's get out of here, you know. But yeah, there is still that there, but I think they definitely hit it, you know, harder in the original script.
Now, did McCoy still shoot it? Like, it still died at the end of the original script, right?
I believe so, yeah. But the doctor survives.
Which I guess would make it more wrong, and that might be what Roddenberry was pushing away from, because after it kills the doctor, I think all bets are off. I mean, like, sure, he showed compassion on it and it showed compassion on him for a while, but it was all for the next fix. And when she couldn't get another fix, she killed him.
Yeah.
So, I think that's why they changed it, so that they could have the ending where everything's wrapped up and McCoy has to shoot his ex-wife or his ex-girlfriend or whatever. So in the end, I feel that, sure, it's not right that they kill the monster, but at least it's somewhat justified in that it killed, I mean, a lot of red shirts and gold shirts and blue shirts. The first red shirt is a blue shirt, by the way, die in this episode. And Kirk is upset every time, which goes against the whole cliche thing that I'm tired of. So we'll call them blue shirts from now on.
Are you just saying that to make Mike feel more comfortable because he's wearing a red shirt right now?
He's wearing a red shirt, and it is making me feel uncomfortable.
Sorry. I'm keeping an eye out, though, you know, just in case.
He's even got a black undershirt on. It's perfect. It took me a while to realize that he probably wasn't cosplaying. Or if he was, it was some kind of sports ball team.
It is for a sports ball team, but I am always cosplaying.
Or sports puck, I think. Is it sports puck?
No, it's actually baseball.
Oh, okay. Sports ball.
Yeah,
all right.
Rhythm.
Yes.
The
one with
sport.
The stick. The one with the stick with the swinging at the ball.
Yes, yes.
All right. Well, we'll talk that about one. That on the next episode of The Locker Room. Matthew and I have that new show, The Locker Room. So, but yeah, I mean, the point is good here. But I'm still bothered by the fact that Kirk, I mean, I'm not bothered by it in this episode itself, but just thinking about this as Star Trek and where the franchise went, you know, what we think of as Star Trek, that Kirk really never, even before Dr. Crater is killed, never makes any attempt to communicate with the creature or find out what it is. It's very much just kind of like a horror story where there's this monster and we have to kill the monster or it's going to kill us. And if you look later on, now, you know, Kirk has a history of destroying life forms in the original series, but also in the way that, you know, people think, and of course in the Abrams verse, they're playing up this idea that Kirk's the ladies' man and he's always after the women. Whereas in reality, in the original series, although he does kiss a lot of alien women or sleep with women, it's because it's necessary to save the ship, to save his crew, to escape the planet. There's something to it. And the same here when he kills things, you know, in Obsession, he destroys that vampiric cloud because it's moving through the galaxy and it's destroying people, it's killing people. In The Immunity Syndrome, he destroys that giant single-celled organism because it's going to reproduce and it could destroy the galaxy. He destroys the little fried egg parasite guys in Operation Annihilate because they're sweeping through the galaxy and causing mass insanity.
He destroys the Doomsday Machine, and all it was doing was the doomsdaying.
Well, it's going to eat planets. Then in The Lights of Zatar, he kills the Zatarian because they're also trying to... They're going to take over bodies. They've already killed a lot of scientists at Memory Alpha, and he has to stop them. So there are all cases where there's like a planetary or a galactic threat. But in this case, the only threat is to his ship. Especially after Dr. Crater's been killed, they could say, well, this is the last of its kind because they talk about the buffalo and this and that. They could immobilize the creature, put it back on the planet, even leave it a supply of salt tablets, and then go on their way. They don't actually have to kill this creature because this creature isn't capable of leaving the planet and harming anyone else. And it feels to me that the Star Trek thing to do would have been to try to find out more about the creature and to be more compassionate towards it and then not kill the creature unnecessarily.
Mm-hmm. The right answer would be to find a planet made of salt and drop it off. I'm sure that there's... Yeah. I mean, I guess it's... Okay, never mind. It's not Star Wars. Most planets have more than one climate. But you know, there's a desert planet and an ice planet. Who says there's not a salt planet? That's just...
Well, you know, Kirk could have taken the creature and marooned it on Salty Alpha 5.
I don't know Star Trek 2, the wrath of the M113 creature.
That in there, I know. That just shows you that there are also planets made purely of cheese.
God, it just gets better and better, doesn't it?
Okay, but seriously, I mean, what do you think about this in terms of how this plays out and the attitude towards a creature who is the last of its kind?
Now, I mean, you're right. You know, and I think that that's something that was brought up at the time too. And at that point in time, for whatever reason, they chose not to do it. And I don't know why, but I agree that, yeah, it would have been better if they had found a more peaceful solution.
The ending would have still been emotional had the phaser been on stun. I mean, McCoy still would have had to have shot who he believed was his ex-girlfriend, even though she did reveal herself too early that she was a crazy suction cup vampire. But it all comes down to Devil in the Dark, which we talked about last episode, last TOS episode, I think. And we did compare these two episodes and how all of a sudden... The Horde is killing people, killing red shirts left and right. Kirk's distraught, as he should be, and he is every time. And the Horde, he wants to save the Horde. And Spock is the one who's like, let's totally murder it, after going back and forth on that a couple times. Maybe Devil in the Dark is an apology for this episode. Maybe they realize that this is what we should have done. This is what Kirk should have done. Maybe the characters, not only the writers, maybe the characters learned from this. If we make our own little headcanon of what happens between episodes, maybe they had a sit down conversation like, sorry, we made you shoot who you thought was your ex-girlfriend. Maybe we could have handled that better. Maybe the counselor of the ship had to talk to everybody and convince them maybe there's more peaceful solutions for you guys to handle. I'm sensing anger.
Yeah. So it's in this situation, I think this is an unusual case within Star Trek. So I think that they had a point at the time that if the franchise had followed the pattern of this particular episode, it would have been quite different. And frankly, I think the Star Trek would not have endured in that case, because it lacks the core of what makes Star Trek so attractive, which is the compassion and the ability to look at different sides of an issue and find solutions and work
that we've
together.
Evolved beyond just shooting whatever gives us problems.
Yeah. But it's also understandable to me how they would go this way in 1966 on a television show. So I can see that. Okay. Well, we're kind of we've hit the end of the episode a number of times as we've talked about what McCoy had to do. So let's wrap up the discussion here. One point I did want to ask, and we've already talked about it so much, maybe it's just, it's a final thought thing here, but how this episode stacks up to Where No Man Has Gone Before and The Cage as a pilot, The Cage being the original pilot that no one saw until many years later, and Where No Man Has Gone Before being the pilot that was the actual second film to pilot. So that question, which again, we've already talked about a lot anyway, and then just final thoughts on The Man Trap. Mike, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't think that this episode is nearly as good as either The Cage or Where No Man Has Gone Before, either as an episode or as an introduction to the series. I mean, I can definitely see why they would, you know, go with this over The Cage. I still cannot quite see why they would go with this over Where No Man Has Gone Before. I mean, the look is a bit more polished. You know, the characters are a bit more fleshed out. But to me, as someone who, you know, is all about continuity and who really likes the idea that Where No Man Has Gone Before is sort of like the story which gets the people into the place that we find them in for the rest of the series, I really would have liked for that to have come first. And if I look back, even, you know, looking at this from a 1966 perspective, I don't think that that changes at all. I would still want to see Where No Man Has Gone Before first. I really can't quite understand why they wouldn't do that. I don't think that, you know, the amount of exposition in it is a problem, because I think what they're talking about is really interesting. And I think on the whole, it is much more compelling than this one is.
And how would you rate this episode if you were going to give this one a rating?
I guess I would give it 3 of those plants which the first dude supposedly ate at the beginning of the episode.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, because this is the key. The bad training at Starfleet, that was a carbon class 3 plant, carbon class 3 vegetation. Everyone knows you can only eat carbon class 4. They should know that before they beam down the planet.
Well, he was a rookie, you know?
He was, yeah. Yeah. And look where it got him. He's dead.
Mm-hmm. See, Sulu with his crazy plants with the dude wearing the pink glove in the pot, which is really freaking obvious, by the way. He wouldn't have made that mistake.
Yes.
he wouldn't have made that mistake. But Blue Shirt there, he didn't stand a chance.
That's an awesome hand costume.
I never noticed it until I was just watching it now, and I'm like, man, I was watching the remastered
version.
Oh,
you never noticed that? Oh, man.
Not, you know, I don't know, but watching the remastered version.
One of my favorite things in TOS. Yeah.
I'm like, man, they totally should have fixed that thing. Out of all the effects in this thing, they don't fix that.
I'm glad they didn't fix it, though, because for me, that's one of the classic TOS things, the Gertrude hand plant. I'm glad they left it. But the noises that Gertrude makes, I think that the crew should have had Gertrude with them on the Bird of Prey in Star Trek IV, because I think Gertrude could have communicated with George and Gracie.
You know what's funny is they have a bunch of memos in this book. The book that I'm looking at is These Are the Voyages by Mark Cushman, which is amazing, by the way. And they have a bunch of memos that went back and forth about that thing where they're basically like, you guys know this is stupid, right? You know that we totally shouldn't do this? And then finally they were like, okay, we'll do one plant and that's it. And that's pushing it, but we'll do it.
So they had like a lot of hand plants going on.
I don't know, because he has like the menagerie of plants and they're like, we'll have one of these things, but that's it, you know? But yeah, there was definitely talk about not doing that. And then in the end, they were just like, we should not have done that. That was a really bad idea. Oh, well.
That reminds me too, there were two product placement opportunities. If this episode were being shot today instead of in 1966, of course there would have been product marketing going on in the episode, and one of them relates to the plant that they ate down on the planet, the Borgia plant. Go back to the Wrigley's Pleasure Planet. You could have had Wrigley's Borgia gum. Mm-hmm. That would have been nice. And because when they pull that out of his mouth, you really think it's like a wad of gum. At first you're thinking like, what, did the creature choke him with some gum? What is this?
The other one is
when the creature is on the ship and sees Rand with the tray of food, and you see the salt shaker and the pepper shaker, bottle of Tabasco instead of salt. The creature would feed off of Tabasco.
There you go.
Perfect opportunity.
And then it would fit into Roswell continuity.
Exactly.
Oh.
That's right.
You know how my wife always comes in at the worst part of whatever episode that I'm watching? She came in during the botany scene. She's like, is that a hand? Yeah. Oh.
Yeah.
This explains why in Space Seed, when they found the Botany Bay, Sulu got really excited at first. Botany Bay? Sounds like my kind of ship.
Yep.
All right, Landry, what are your final thoughts on the episode and your rating?
Well, as the first episode, I don't think it's the best. It's an okay episode. I think I agree with Mike that Where No Man Has Gone Before was already done and should have been the first episode. It does a pretty good job introducing everybody but McCoy. And it would be a lot better placed at the beginning than in the middle, when all of a sudden there's no Dr. McCoy and Spock is shouty McShouty pants.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's an okay episode. It's one of those things that if you sit your friend down to watch it, you got to explain, look, there's going to be some corn, there's going to be some cheese, but there is actually a message in there, even if the characters ignore it. So I give it 3 Gertrude fingers out of 5 Gertrude fingers.
Yeah, for me, I'm fine with the episode itself as an episode. I've traditionally watched TOS out of order. I used to have them on VHS tape. Do you guys remember how they used to sell them in the bookstore? Like one episode per tape for $15.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I had those, and so I used to just watch TOS at random. And so, you know, as an individual episode, it's fine. I enjoyed it. It's a TOS episode. My criticisms of it come from looking back at it. You know, how does it set up Star Trek? How does it fit into the overall theme of Star Trek, as we've discussed already? And then same with you guys, as a pilot episode to the public, the first thing they see, yeah, probably not. I've always thought it was an odd choice to be the pilot episode, but you know, the characters are great. I think William Shatner is great in here. I'm actually watching it, and as he's crawling around, running through the planet, crawling around, and I'm thinking, you know, William Shatner's awesome. Who else could play this role?
Exactly.
He's just great in here, so I enjoy that too.
Did he do any barrel rolls? I wasn't paying attention.
If he did, they didn't catch it on camera, but the way he was snaking around through there, I'm pretty sure at some point he had to do one. So I like the episode itself as an episode, and I'm going to give it 1 bushel of Mexican Reds. All right. Well, guys, we have the two of you together. Of course, Drew, you're always on the Ready Room when we do TOS anyway, but we have Mike with us today for a very important reason, and that is that I am very pleased to tell everyone that the two of you are going to be fleshing out at long last our collection of series-focused podcasts with our new show, Standard Orbit.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this. It's been a long time coming. I've got a lot of ideas of how to make this go.
Are you a Packlet? Are you Geordi? Are you Geordi helping Packlets?
I know how to make things go. No, I've been really excited about this for a long time, and I'm glad that Mike is going to help us out. We'll have individual episodes. We'll do episode commentaries. We also get to talk about the movies. So we'll talk about 1 through 6 and maybe half of 7. Not half. The 20 minutes that Kirk's in.
the guys on Earl Grey, they like to say, we have movies. Well, you guys have more movies.
We have more movies. We have less episodes. We have more movies.
Well, for and generations, we also, we'll have to do a crossover with Earl Grey, right?
Yes.
You should, yeah.
There you go.
Exactly. So it's, you know, it's going to be like Earl Grey, The Orb, To the Journey, Warp 5. Yeah, you know, broad look at the series, looking at various aspects, characters and all. So
yeah, we won't go straight through the episodes.
So I'm really excited that finally we're going to have all five series covered in that way.
5 days a week.
For sure. And as someone who, you know, is not nearly as familiar with the original series as Drew, I'm excited to learn just as much as the listener will learn about this new show. So, or this old show, whatever. It's new to
what I'm hoping.
New in, right. In cosmic terms, you know. It's only been around for like 47 years, but yeah.
That's all.
What I like, what I'm hoping to do is to show we're so big on the other franchises because we've had the other shows around now, on the network, but TOS is the core that establishes the rules and things, and I think that as we focus on the core, even if you don't like TOS, I think it'll help you appreciate whichever one you do like more, not just by going back to the beginning, but really learning to appreciate how Gene Roddenberry and the other writers matured over the last 47 years.
Yeah. Yeah. I find a lot of fans these days, and it's completely understandable. It's completely natural because, I mean, like you said, Mike, it's been around for 47 years. So I find a lot of fans don't really know the original series as well as they know the other series. A lot of fans don't know anything about the original series other than they know who the characters are, and maybe they've seen the films, but they haven't seen every episode of TOS 20 times like a lot of us have, you know, 50 times because we grew up with it. And so it will be a wonderful way for people to go back and learn more about where it all started.
Yeah, and that's where I'm coming from. I've seen every episode at least twice, you know, and I've seen the ones that I love a million times, but, you know, for those people who aren't familiar with the original series like they are with the other shows, you know, don't be scared away because it's not going to be so inside that you won't have any idea what we're talking about. We'll definitely make it accessible to people who want to learn about the original series and not just people who are huge fans of it.
Excellent. Well, I am really excited for the first episode to drop, and Standard Orbit is going to be on the network on Mondays. Now, we're going to do a little bit of shifting around to get our series shows in the order that they aired on television, not in the order on the timeline. So Warp 5 will continue to be on Friday as the fifth series that aired on television, even though it came before Kirk's era. So looking forward to that. So thanks so much, guys, for putting that show together for us. And lastly, before we let you go, Drew, tell everyone where they can find you apart from Standard Orbit.
They can find me on Twitter at 005, and they can find me pretty much everywhere under that screen name. So find me, say nice things. I don't like mean things. It's not nice.
Very good. All right. Well, thanks again for joining us today, Drew.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Mike, again, I'm really glad that you and Drew were able to join me on the show together this week, you know, to kick off Standard Orbit. I'm really excited that you guys are going to be doing the TOS show on the network. And finally, we have all of the live action series covered with dedicated shows.
Yeah, I'm really excited too. I mean, this is a really, you know, Drew is going to be helming this ship here. I'm just the first officer, or maybe just a, not even that, maybe just like a navigator or something. I don't know. But
well, he's Landru, and you're going to be the guy with the cane, right? You're going to wear the
I'm going to be one of those random natives to that planet who's running around like crazy with absolutely no idea what I'm doing. So that's me.
So, well, it's going to be fun to hear.
Yeah, it'll be a lot of fun. And now that we've got all the other shows done, when are you going to start up your animated series with your kids? That's what I want to see.
Oh, okay. Well, now that's a good point. I have actually tried to get my son to watch the animated Star Trek series before when he was younger, and he just couldn't get into it. So,
well, to be fair,
I don't know.
I mean, come on. Seriously? The animated series.
You know, but my kids are just, they're not into Star Trek. You would think with all the Star Trek stuff going on here in the house that they would get some interest in it, but no, they're really not. Although we did talk about during the Mantrap today about it being kind of a reverse Scooby-Doo. If I present it to my daughter in that way, she might be into it because she is just diehard Scooby-Doo right now.
All right. Scooby-Doo.fm coming in what, 10, 15 years?
Well, I'm going to wait until the .inc domain is available, and then I'm going to have mystery.inc. I think that's the best way to go for Scooby-Doo.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good.
All right. Well, so we've talked about the Mantrap, but you know, it's not the only thing we've talked about on the network this week. So here are some other things that you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, the Orb.
Looking for Parlock in all the wrong places.
Well, and you also get the feeling here that she's only... Worf really is only being rejected because she's not interested. It has nothing to do with whether or not Worf is Klingon enough or any of that. She's just not interested. She's interested in Quark.
Earl Grey.
Romulans on TNG.
You know, it's this TV trope of an actor playing their own descendant or... you know, it doesn't make sense. Okay, fine. If you want to...
Right, because Data never plays his grandfather or great-grandfather or own descendant, but, you know, that's a terrible storyline.
Or Michael Dorn.
The Ready Room.
Well, I think after what he went through with the Zindi, you know, you see he's become very jaded. He's very cynical about things, and it would be easy for him to stay in that place, and it would continue to grow, and he would become nothing like the person he was, and even lose sight of the person that he was and never be able to get back there.
To the journey!
Voyager's funniest moments.
They're seeing Sandrines for the first time, and you see that pool shark guy who is such a chauvinist pig jerk who says something to the effect to B'Elanna, something like, "Treat a lady like a tramp and a tramp like a lady. It works every time." And she says, "Paris, did you program this guy?" And he's like, "Yeah, why?" She said, "He's a pig, and so are you."
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Battlestar Galactica.
But with the new series, it really tried to delve much deeper into the social commentary. You know, in a lot of ways, I think it was an excellent portrayal of a post-9/11 world. And I think it touched on a lot of aspects of our society.
Warp 5.
Hoshisato.
I'm not so sure that I can relate to the background as providing an explanation for her personal insecurities. I perhaps wondered if a part of that, I mean, you put her on Earth in her element, doing her teaching, working with languages in that safe environment. I don't think she would have the same level of insecurity.
Trek News and Views.
Barge of the Dead.
So to actually get a character episode that doesn't just explore B'Elanna, but explores the Klingon mythos at the same time. I mean, that was two for one.
Literary Treks.
David R. George III, Revelation and Dust.
And it feels like an evolution for Starfleet as well in the way that they built a starbase.
Well, I'm glad that came across because that was sort of one of the things that I was going for. You wanted it to be an evolution in Starfleet's construction of starbases. Mm-hmm. It should be something brand new. And because it's an important station, because it's in an important location, it really needed to be, I thought, a grand station.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and get that daily Trek Talk fix. We have new Trek Talk for you every day of the week, and some days now we even have two shows for you. And you can find them in all sorts of places, including iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Zune, Xbox. You can stream or download from the website. There are many ways for you to get the shows, and you can go to trek.fm/pd for podcast directory to get all the links. Now, Mike, let's tell everyone where to contact us if they'd like to share their thoughts on the Mantrap, of course, on TOS, Standard Orbit, or most likely their hate messages about our Star Trek television series talk from the news segment today. You can do that by going to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. You can choose to send to a show, choose the ready room, and that will come to us by email. There's also a tab on the right-hand side of the website on all the pages. If you click that, you can use your webcam's microphone to send us a voicemail and upload it to us as an MP3 file. We also have forums at trek.fm/forums. There's a section there for the Ready Room. There's one for the original series. There will be one for Standard Orbit here shortly. And there's one for every other topic you can think about as well for Star Trek. So go over there, talk to other listeners and the Trek FM crew about Star Trek. And then if you prefer social media, you'll find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. And you'll find us on Twitter, where we're always tweeting away about Star Trek under username TrekFM. Now, Mike, if people want to contact you directly and talk about Star Trek or anything else, of course, you guys do all the non-Trek stuff on Commentary Trek Stars as well. Where should they go?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at ComTrackStars, or you can email me at mike.schindler@trek.fm. Or you can find our other show, Commentary Track Stars, on our website, commentarytrackstars.com, where we talk about TV shows and movies and various other crazy things.
And of course, I mentioned earlier the Commentary Track Stars, and people heard it in the promo, but you and Max have some great interviews over there too with people who have worked on Star Trek, writers and such, and you also talk about their work. So it's a great extension of Star Trek for people to check out as well.
Yeah, right now we're covering Ronald D. Moore's work as a showrunner, and that's going to go on for another couple weeks. And then after that, in just a few weeks at the start of November, we're going to have a two-part series that I think fans of the original series will be really excited about, or I hope that fans of the original series will be really excited about. We talked to Mark Cushman, who wrote the amazing book, These Are the Voyages, about the making of the original series, as well as John D.F. Black and his wife, Mary Black. John D.F. Black is a producer of season one of the original series, and his wife was his assistant as well. And it was just amazing to talk to these Star Trek legends and get the inside scoop on what it was they were doing, what went into making that show. So definitely check that out in a few weeks.
Yeah, that's really great. It's great that you're able to talk to them now too, because everyone who worked on the original series is getting older, and it's just great to still be able to get firsthand a lot of those experiences, because eventually, of course, there will come a time where we won't be able to do that anymore. So
yeah,
I'm glad we're getting that down on audio for everyone right now.
Yeah, and we really appreciate them taking the time to talk to us, because they're just a wealth of information there,
Oh, most definitely. Yeah. Well, if you'd like to find me, you can do that as well. My username on Twitter is C Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much everywhere on social media under that same username, as well as at my own website at cbrianjones.com. And then on the network, I do two shows with Matthew Rushing. There's Literary Treks, where we talk Star Trek books and comics and interview authors. There's The Orb, where we talk all things Deep Space Nine. And then on Fridays, I'm with Kate Walsh on Warp 5, where we talk Enterprise exclusively, but we also interview a lot of people involved with the creation of Star Trek. We've had Brandon Braga on the show. We've had Doug Drexler, who we talked about a lot in news today, on the show. We had Robbie Duncan McNeil on. So a lot of stuff there for you, even if you're not a huge Enterprise fan. So go check those out as well. Also, Mike, before we go, we'd like to ask everyone to please support our sponsor for this week's show. Again, your support of our sponsor is very important for making it possible for us to bring the Ready Room to you every week. And that sponsor is Squarespace, the web's best hosting and CMS that makes it simple for you to create a beautiful blog, website, portfolio, online store, really anything you can imagine. Don't forget to check out Mike's Hikaru Sulu admiration site, coming soon to a browser near you. But, create whatever you'd like to create yourself. I promise you're going to love it. Just go to squarespace.com for that free 14-day trial. And then, as a Trek FM listener, use offer code TREK10 to save 10% off your lifetime purchase on new accounts, and choose the annual plan to get that custom domain registration. And we really thank Squarespace for their support of the Ready Room and the network. Also, there's another way you can support what we're doing at Trek FM as well. If you'd like to have some aliens in your life, go to trek.fm/donate, where we have 8 original alien illustrations by Tobu Uchi, who does most of the artwork that you see on our website. And we have those available both as badges and as art prints, and you can choose which ones you want. You can mix and match. We have different contribution levels for you to choose from. So choose what's right for you, choose the aliens you want, and we'll get those right over to you. And your donations make it possible for us to cover the costs of production, storage, and bandwidth that's needed to bring this programming to you every week. So again, that's at trek.fm/donate, and we really appreciate your support of the network.
I have the Gorn badge, and it has changed my life. I wear it on my backpack, and every time I see it, anytime I pick up my backpack or look in a mirror while I'm wearing my backpack, I see the Gorn on my shoulder, and it just makes me smile. It makes me know that I'm safe.
Does he ever challenge you to a duel?
Not me. Other people. And my cat.
Other people?
Yeah.
Okay.
But no,
someone tries to
he's got
get
my
your
back.
Seat on the subway.
No.
He's got your back.
He's got
That's
my
right.
backpack. Yeah.
All right. So again, that's at trek.fm/donate. And we really appreciate your support of the network. And yours too, Mike.
Thanks.
All right, Mike. Well, I'm going to wander down the corridors. You know, earlier I saw the Morton Salt girl walking around, and I'm really worried about her. So I'm going to go try to find her before that creature finds her.
All right. Well, while you do that, I'm going to stick Gertrude in it because the ready room is done. See your hands on my face.